We like sports and we don't care who knows.
Yes.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Well, look, if you're the Mexican Mac O'Grady, you got to figure out why I'm still shaking the ball.
You know.
Now, what's the problem? I'm catching on the hosel, right?
Yeah, right.
Moving my head?
Yeah.
I'm laying it off?
Well, that too.
I'm pronating?
When you're not supinating.
I'm clearing too early. I'm clearing too late. My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Hello, everybody. It's episode 166 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hidely ho, Rusarinos.
Yeah. And we're also joined by Jeremy Scott.
I literally sat down 2 seconds before this thing started. I totally lost track of time in the break.
Wow. Just under the gun. Today's big recommend is Tin Cup, which last week I said was Ron Shelton's sports follow-up to Bull Durham and couldn't have been more wrong about that. He actually did White Men Can't Jump and Cobb between these two movies and did no other kind of movie in between Bull Durham and Tin Cup other than sports movies. He even did another one after that called Play It to the Bone. So anyway.
You like sports?
Yeah, he does. He does. He used to play baseball way back in the day or something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Also, would like to welcome chat who've come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We'd like to welcome you guys in. Thank you so much for coming out. Let's start us off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Jeremy, what do you got?
I stumbled across a movie. I freaking love when this happens. I even came in the company Slack and said, I freaking love when this happens. I stumbled across a fairly recent movie I'd never heard of. I watched it. It has almost nobody. I recognized a few faces, but almost nobody whose name I recognize. And it's great. It's called The Last Stop in Yuma County. And this is a 2023 crime movie. Set in the 70s, in the middle of nowhere, a knife salesman stops at a gas station diner and is told, we are out of gas, and it's 100 miles to the next gas station, but there is a gas truck coming today. So the guy decides to stop and go into the diner. And there's a radio broadcast that we overhear that talks about a bank robbery that's happened. And $750,000 has been stolen by people in a green Pinto. And then who should show up at the diner not too long after that, but two guys in a green Pinto. And there are people in the diner. There are people who arrive after the bank robbers. There are cops who show up at one point. And the thing about this movie that I appreciated the most is it makes a fresh, unique choice at almost every turn where it could have made a cliche, rote kind of choice. It kept things interesting by basically breaking what would feel like the conventional next move. And so all the way up to the end, I was not knowing what was going to happen. All the way up to the end, I didn't know what was going to happen. And it kept surprising me. Unfortunately, this is not streaming right now anywhere. I saw it on one of the movie channels. I can't even tell you which one it was because Google's not telling me. But if you find it, I think you would enjoy it. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 97, which is pretty high. Not to toot my own horn. But yeah, the guy who's the lead, the knife salesman, is the lead from The Wolf of Snow Hollow? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Another obscure movie that I really, really enjoyed. really, really like this. There you go.
That does sound very interesting. And you just randomly saw it on a movie channel, huh?
Yeah.
Like just a TMC or an HBO or something?
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the, it wasn't HBO. It was one of the bottom ones on my guide.
That doesn't help you. Oh, I'll check that out tonight. Let me see. What's at the bottom of Jeremy's guide tonight?
Right. I'll go over to Real Good and see when this that movie's at the bottom of Jeremy's guide. if you subscribe. All right, Aaron, what do you got?
I watched a two-part documentary called Pee-wee as Himself. And this is, as you might know, Pee-wee Herman Paul Rubens passed away recently. Well, before he passed away, he commissioned this documentary. There are several things that are really, really interesting about this and, in my opinion, make it worth watching. Number one, it is the most behind the person I've ever got on Paul Rubens, like to really see him sit down, talk about himself, his career, kind of how he saw the character of Pee-wee, why he decided to kind of let Paul Rubens disappear and Pee-wee become an actual person, you know, kind of thing happen. It goes over his time in The Groundlings with Phil Hartman and some other names you probably know. There's a lot of backstory I didn't know about his life, and I found him personable, hilarious, and also a troll, which is not something I was necessarily expecting. He trolls the director of this documentary countless times through the documentary, but the director uses it to kind of establish kind of his personality and who he is. And the heart of that trolling is that he thinks he would make a better documentary about himself than this guy is making about him. And it leads to some really interesting moments of, you know, the difference between what you think is more interesting and important about your life and what somebody else may think is more interesting and important in your life. It covers everything you'd expect it to cover. It covers the adult movie arrest. It covers the suspected pedophilia that was really, trumped up as far as anybody can tell when you really look into it. And it's deep. It's introspective. It's interesting. It's 2 1.5 hour episodes. So it's like a 3.5 hour documentary total. Oh, but I think it's well worth your time. So
I thought they were just rerunning it. When I saw it on my guide, it was always playing back to back. And I thought they were just pushing it extra hard by running it constantly.
Hmm. No,
there's two episodes.
No, it's two. I think it's Max, right? I think this one is hopping around on Max.
Yeah, it's
I could
on
be
Max.
Wrong. Okay. So,
yeah, it's
but
like I've seen it pop up.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it. I think it's very interesting.
I should have watched this instead of Mountainhead.
it's always interesting. Like, I don't think anybody knows what's going to take off. I mean, when he was Pee-wee Herman, I don't think he realized that would be basically his whole persona. And it was always odd to see him in other movies after you saw him as Pee-wee. You see him in like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Blow and stuff like that. And it's like but he's good in those movies. It's just that, you know, he's tied to that one. I mean, I know it's typecasting or whatever, but like he's tied to that one character so hard that it's like, you know, it's hard to get that out of your head when you're watching anything.
Isn't he in Mystery Men?
He is.
Yeah, he's a Mystery Man. Man.
Definitely is in Mystery Men. And the doc, there's some Mystery Men in this doc too, in case you were wanting to see that. But a lot of what you're talking about, Chris, what I found, one of the things I found really interesting about the doc is how self-imposed that was. Like that was a decision he made to go on David Letterman as Pee-wee Herman and not Paul Rubens to, you know, make this an actual persona, not just a character. And it's a decision that was responsible for his lightning success, but also he regretted later on in his life. So yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. I went to the theaters last week and I watched Bring Her Back. I will give you guys some caveats right off the bat. This is not for everybody. I know that's weird in a section where I'm recommending it to you guys, but this movie's got some real like shocking stuff in it. And so, if you're not ready for that kind of violence or this kind of like kind of body torture type stuff or whatever, then you don't want to watch this. But this movie comes from the twin brothers, the Philippou brothers, who did talk to me. Talk to me, hopefully. Yeah, talk to me. Which was also very good. It came out a few years ago. But this movie hasn't. I don't think she's ever been unexcellent. Sally Hawkins, who I can say right now, early on, I feel like she should get nominated for this performance. That's how good she is in this. Mm. Probably won't, but it's one of those performances that I really really enjoyed. But the story is about two kids who already have a single father. The single father dies in the shower, and the two kids are then put into a foster home, and the older brother of this in this group, there's a brother and there's his sister who is blind, and the older brother is 17 and is like 3 months away from being 18. So there's this weird dynamic where they almost don't even get adopted or fostered by the same person at first. There's a possibility that they could even get broken up. But he appeals to, the Sally Hawkins who fosters them to take them both in. So he is about to be 18 and he wants to be the guardian at some point, but he's got to prove it basically while he's living in the house with Sally Hawkins. Sally Hawkins has another kid living there, and this kid has been has a shaved head, acts really odd. We don't know anything about what's going on there, and we also know that there are some videos that she watches that are very disturbing, and they obviously have something to do with this movie, but we don't know exactly what she's trying to do. We also know that she has a daughter who died and that she's trying to be a loving mother and all this other stuff, but she comes off odd. She can be sweet, but she can also be scary at times. And as the movie goes along, we find out, okay, I don't want to go any further because you want to find out for yourself what's going on in this movie. But I can tell you that there is a lot of like just brutal stuff in this. It's not so brutal that you're just like, oh, come on, just quit it already. It's not like that. But the violence, when it does happen, is visceral. So just so that you know when that if you ever decide to watch this. But yeah, movie that didn't do terribly like huge business, but I don't think these movies are ever meant to be that kind of thing. Hopefully it'll kind of find an audience as it goes along.
I did like Talk to Me. I really liked the way that movie ended and the things that it had to say. So if there's a substantial enough thematic stuff in here to make me think, then mm-hmm. then I'm fine, you know, bearing the torture if I need to.
Yeah.
Pain can result in growth.
Yep. Yeah. I'll tell you, there's some pretty shocking things in here. I'm not gonna lie to you. But anyway, there you go. That's a bit of pleasantness for you. Let's go on to our big recommend, which is Tin Cup, and this is Jeremy's pick. So Jeremy, take us away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
All right. Tin Cup is a sports comedy from 1996 starring Kevin Costner in the title role and directed by Ron Shelton, re-teaming the actor with the director from Bull Durham. It's also the shortest 2-hour-and-15-minute movie ever made. We open with music and visuals designed to teach you one thing. You are in the Texas sticks. We settle on a driving range as we see a modified Herbie the Love Bug collecting balls and a sign that warns that theft of range balls is punishable by law. Which is odd, because everyone knows range balls suck complete ass, and no one would want to own them or use them for regular golf, and no one even likes using them for driving range purposes, but we have collectively just accepted it as a society, not unlike the way we just accepted Bill Maher's garbage takes for years.
Wow, you found that all in the all in the beginning of the movie? Is all that?
We haven't even rolled the opening credits all the way through yet.
Listen, sometimes I have opinions. We also get several gratuitous armadillo shots. As evening sets in, we settle on Costner's Roy McAvoy hitting golf balls on the range that we will soon learn he owns. We also see his best friend Romeo, Cheech Marin, and the rest of the gang drinking beers and betting on which bugs will next be zapped by the bug zapper. In case you weren't already convinced, you were in the Texas sticks. Roy tells the gang a riddle that is older than I am, but they are all too dumb to get it, except for Rene Russo, who walks in unexpectedly and asks for a golf lesson because her boyfriend is a golfer. She tells him she's a psychologist before he makes fun of all the golf swing gadgets she's brought with her. She ultimately asks him to break down a good golf swing into words, and he does a routine he's clearly done a dozen times with female clients before comparing it to a poem. On her third swing, Molly makes good contact, and Roy suggests they end the lesson on a good shot, even though it's only been 10 minutes tops. He asks her to pay him in cash, but she challenges him, asking why he's living such a life when he's capable of so much more. She then leaves without paying him anything. The next morning, Don Johnson shows up, and he's David Sims, an old golf rival of Roy's, and says he's come to offer a spot to Roy in an upcoming pro-am, only to reveal at the end that he merely wants Roy to caddy and not to play. Romeo tells him off, but Roy accepts the offer. During said tournament, Roy urges David to go for the green on a par 5, but David wants to lay up. David's partner goes for it, rather than after Roy tells him he himself could make it, but the ball goes in the water. David then lays up, but on a bet with the playing partner, Craig Stadler, for all you golf aficionados from the 90s. Roy takes the shot himself and makes it on the green, and David fires him on the spot. Afterwards, Roy tells Romeo he'd still hit that shot if he had it to do all over again, and Romeo says one of my favorite lines in the movie, "You'd bury yourself alive just to prove you could handle the shovel." Roy counters that you either define the moment or the moment defines you, but then Romeo just starts listing off all the times Roy let his pride get the better of him on the golf course, and there are a lot of them. It lays out exactly why Roy is the owner of a dumpy driving range in bumfuck Texas. We next get to meet Roy's ex, Doreen, who owns the Golden Tassel, a strip club that serves $4 steaks. And let's be honest, I'm not going to judge anyone for going to a strip club, but if you order a $4 steak while there, I will judge the fuck out of you. Despite owing her $12,000, Roy gives her the deed to the driving range, and they ultimately agree it's worth about $10,000 and that Roy still owes her $2,000. We then see Roy pawning his golf clubs to try and make up some of the money he owes her. Roy shows up late to Molly's second lesson, and I continue to wonder why she ultimately sees beyond his rude behavior to find something lovable underneath. He continues to flirt with her openly until David Sims shows up, and dun-dun-dun, he's her boyfriend. Embarrassed after Molly and David leave, Roy whines about not being able to compete with Sims for Molly's hand, until Romeo jokingly suggests if you win the U.S. Open, that would impress her. But Roy takes to the idea, and I'm glad he does, because it's the basis of the entire movie. Because the U.S. Open is democratic in that literally anyone over a certain handicap can play as long as they win in the right qualifying tournaments. And it's this completely real thing that makes this movie work. To get his clubs out of hock, he challenges a local golfer who has already lost a Winnebago to Roy in a previous golf bet to a golf match where Roy only uses things like a rake, a hoe, a shovel, and a baseball bat. Roy wins easily. But when Doreen refuses to give him the time off to go play golf, Roy decides he's stuck and in need of a shrink, leading to an all-timer of a line from Romeo saying, "You can't ask advice about the woman you're trying to hose from the woman you're trying to hose." And that reminds me of the time I ended a first date by saying, "Do you think it's possible to talk too much at the end of the date?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Shit." And that's a true story. Back to the film. Roy goes to see Molly anyway, and I love that his version of dressing nice is a short sleeve button up shirt, a terrible tie tied terribly, and a greasy ball cap. Anyway, not understanding how things work and not reading the door right in front of his face, Roy enters the exit and sits in the exit room, believing it to be the lobby. This leads to an encounter when an emotional patient enters after her session to have a good cry, but doesn't notice Roy at first. When she does, she screams, and Molly comes running. In his therapy session, Roy is called on his bullshit by Molly, and she encourages him to take risks with his love life the way he does on the golf course and just tell this woman he's talking about how he feels. And then he does, and Molly instantly regrets it because the woman is her. She tells him he should leave, but before he does, he tells her that her boyfriend hates old people, children, and dogs, which is very specific, but ultimately true. Ultimately, she decides to help Roy because she's the only therapist in town and he'd have to drive 100 miles to find another one. And I actually do kind of like appreciate her commitment to mental health here, even though still probably not an appropriate doctor-patient relationship to have. Her reasoning for it is she wants to provide mental health to somebody, mental health care for somebody who wants it and needs it. All right, she proposes that she be his mental caddy and help him through the qualifying tournaments. And I don't think it's ever explained in the movie how Doreen ends up changing her mind to let him take time off to go play in these tournaments. Probably was on the cutting room floor. But for some reason, I was looking for that this time through, and it never happened. On the 10th hole of the first tournament, Roy is feeling cocky and wants to hit driver, while Romeo recommends the safer play, a 2-iron off the tee. This devolves into a fight that I'm guessing these two have had many times and culminates in Roy and Romeo breaking all the clubs in the bag one by one until he's left with just a 7-iron. Romeo walks off the course, quitting, and Roy goes on to win the tournament with only a 7-iron. And then comes probably one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie, as Roy is bragging about his day with his friends. David approaches. I don't even know why David is here. I guess maybe because Molly's here. But anyway, he makes a bet with Roy to see who can hit the 7-iron the furthest. And after Roy clobbers one down the driving range, David turns and hits his ball down the street, winning the bet and Roy's car. And Roy's friend says, shit, he hit it down the fucking road.
That's one of the funniest lines.
It's so funny. Roy's chubby friend Earl takes over caddying duties for the second qualifying tournament, but can't make the full round, and Roy ends up caddying for himself. As an aside, I just read this morning that Max Homa had to do this yesterday in a U.S. Open qualifying tournament because he apparently has fired his caddy right before the tournament, carried his own bag for 36 holes. Okay. At the driving range. Oh, wait. Rubbies. Now I'm not even saying real words. He returns to the driving range to find a grumpy Romeo. It only takes a few minutes for them to make up, and Romeo agrees to be his caddy once again. At a driving range session, Roy is revealed to have the yips. He has lost his swing. He has the shanks. And this is a very real thing that happens to regular golfers, though not the pros very often. Romeo suspects the issue is Molly, the doctor lady, as he calls her. Roy continues to shank the ball long into the night. The next morning, Molly arrives in Roy's Cadillac and finds Roy using all the golf aid gadgets he had panned earlier. He admits his swing is struggling, and she tells him David never intended to keep the car. He drives her back home, stopping a bit at the river, where Roy again tries to convince her that David is the wrong guy, and as typical, he goes too far. Then, after a beat, he says, "We could kiss," and leans in, but she stops him and asks him to take her home. And honestly, I love this movie, but Roy is absolutely breaking all kinds of guy code rules by constantly flirting with Molly and talking down her boyfriend. But whatever, Roy is Kevin Costner and he's charming, so we go with what is essentially relationship sabotage. At the driving range at the U.S. Open, Roy's swing yips continue until Romeo commands him to tie a double knot in one shoe and move stuff between his pockets and turn his hat around backwards. And it works, which Romeo attributes to Roy not thinking about golf or the doctor lady, but just about how silly he looks. And with that, Roy is cured of the yips, which is probably the least accurate golf thing about this movie. Romeo suggests they get drunk because Roy always plays better when he's wasted, forgetting that if they drink tonight, tomorrow Roy will not be wasted anymore, he'll be hungover. As a result, Roy plays like absolute dog shit in the first round, putting up an 83, which realistically is not an opening round score someone could come back from to win, but it's a movie, so we allow it. Another pretty unrealistic moment in this movie that goes way too far in sandbagging Roy. After the round, Molly sees David act extremely rudely to an old couple and their grandchild and dog, who are played by Costner's parents and his own son, by the way. Later in the bar, David twists a knife on Roy like a dickhead, and Molly sees him for his true self and bets him that Roy can hit a ball out of the bar, across the water, and hit a post, making a pelican on that post fly away. It's notable that former golfer announcer Gary McCord is in the bar and ends up doing play-by-play of this trick shot, because this entire scene is based on a real-life event Gary McCord himself did. Roy, of course, nails the shot, and now Molly is officially Team Roy. So much so that Molly and Roy have sex in the RV that night, leaving Romeo to pace back and forth outside in the rain like assholes. And honestly, go have sex in the rain and let Romeo sleep, you dicks. We then cut to the end of the second round as the TV crew and announcers tell us that an unknown Roy Tin Cup McAvoy has had a round for the ages to bring himself back into contention and has only the par 5 18th left to set a course record. Roy decides to go for the green in two, but hits it in the water. He then goes up, drops, and makes his par to finish round two, claiming the U.S. Open single round record and vaulting himself back into contention. And there are entirely too many shots of Kevin Costner himself making incredible golf shots. It's like Costner only agreed to film this if he was guaranteed the chance to show off his actual golf skills, even though every putt, chip, and shot he's shown doing himself in this movie probably took 40 takes each. Okay, I had to get that off my chest. At a Waffle House that night, the gang from Texas shows up just after Roy name checks them, and then somehow they put multiple tables together, despite my never having been inside a single Waffle House in all my years of living in the South that had movable tables. If they have them, they are not in Nashville. Them shits are always bolted down around the outside or along the bar. Okay. Anyway, at the diner, Romeo flirts with Doreen. The gang from Salome argues about where in Texas is the Waffle House that looks exactly like this one. And Roy and Molly look on in happiness. In the third round, Roy is still in contention on the 18th and once again tries to go for the green in two, saying to Romeo, "This is for Ken Venturi in the booth, saying I should lay up." Romeo replies under his breath, "Yeah, what does he know? He only won this tournament before you were born," which is true. Roy again puts the ball in the water. He asks for another ball to prove he can make the shot, but Romeo reminds him he should walk up, drop, and make par like he did yesterday. In the post-round press conference, Roy defends going for the green 2 days in a row, saying he himself is a low-percentage shot, as the shot he was trying to make on 18. Finally, it's time for the last round, and Roy is paired in the final group with David Sims. Roy struggles early, but after banking a shot off a porta-potty, winning a $50 bet with Gary McCord in the process, he turns things around. Roy and Sims trade great shots for the rest of the round, more Costner really making the shot crap, and it all comes down to, you guessed it, the 18th hole. Once again, Roy decides to go for it when all he needs is par to win. After putting it in the water, Roy horrifies everyone watching by dropping and hitting again from the same spot, again putting the ball in the water. At this point, the tournament is lost for him, but his pride remains, and he tries a few more times before actually hitting the ball onto the green and holing out for a dramatic 12. This is also based on a real-life Gary McCord event where he melted down on the final hole. He needed birdie to win, and he hit it in the water and kept doing it. He got a 15 in real life. The movie thought that was too outrageous and brought it down to a 12. Afterwards, processing what has happened, Roy is dejected, beating himself up for losing, saying, "I just gave away the U.S. Open." But Molly reminds him that in a few years, no one will remember this tournament at all. Who won, who lost, but Roy's dramatic 12 would live forever. "My God, it's immortal," she declares. In the coda, we see Roy and Molly cuddling on a couch as she tells him how many new PGA clients she's picked up after the U.S. Open and encourages him to go to qualifying school and join the tour. And then she says, "We could kiss," and they start making out, and that is Tin Cup. What did you guys think of the movie?
I haven't seen this in forever. I don't remember the last time I watched it. I think I used to watch this quite a bit, though. Like, it used to come on cable or something like that. I used to watch it. But this is really good. I actually personally felt the length this time watching it. I understand what you mean by it being the shortest 2-hour and 15-minute movie, because you're loving every minute of it or whatever. And for me, there's some moments that I'm like, come on, get on with it. So there are some spots here that I would trim. There's a point where they cut the whole golf action down to have Rene Russo and the ex-girlfriend sit there and banter back and forth about stories and stuff. And like, the Tin Cup story isn't a great story, really. Right. It's not really that legendary or whatever. But we take this, we cut into that golf tournament just to tell you that, by the way, this is how he got his name and all these other stuff. But anyway, I enjoy this movie, obviously. There's so many moments in this. You mentioned the thing about, you know, oh, shit, man, he knocked down a fucking road. I love that part. Just the way he says it. And it's off screen, too. They didn't cut to the guy to say it. It's just you hear it in the background, and I love that type of thing. There is a scene in here that I was like, man, I could have a whole movie of just the broadcast crew in this whole thing, especially the British guy who, when he that cuts to him and they tell, and he's telling everybody that Gary McCord is down there seeing how Roy's going to hit this shot off the porta potty and everything. He says, we now go down live to Gary McCord, who has spent a lot of his days in darkness and, you know, whatever. It's just such a beautiful thing. He's spending much of his days in forests and darkness or something like that. I love that line so much. When, of course, I love the fact that this movie doesn't go for the Disney ending. The whole thing where he's like, man, you know what, if he just had another shot at that, getting that on the green, he'd do it, and he's gonna do it when it's championship time and everything. Except they've actually weirdly ironically set it up where it would be stupid for him to actually hit that shot because he's ahead. He should do the smart thing. It's not the it'd be a completely different movie if he was down by one and then he had to make that shot. But they made it where, come on, man, make the smart choice. You can win by doing the smart thing here. And that's not his character whatsoever. And you know, this is a point where Romeo, obviously we've seen him walk off before when Roy gets into these types of these modes that he's in or whatever. And it's finally, the thing is the last ball is the last ball. Like if he hits it in the water, he can't turn in a car.
He's disqualified. Yeah.
He's disqualified. He can't go to the Masters. He can't go to the next US Open, whatever. And Romeo gives him that ball and he's like, I know I can make that shot. I know I can. And he's like, I know you can too, Roy. Now stop fucking around. You know? it's just Cheech Marin is great in this. This is like a small period of time where Cheech Marin was getting in a ton of movies. Like he showed up in Desperado and he showed up in The Great White Hype. It was another movie I kind of really enjoy. And, you know, he's just excellent in this. What else in this? I don't know. I like Renee Russo. I don't know if I like her in this movie, and I don't know if it's the character that she's playing or what, but there are moments in this that I'm not getting grabbed by the character. So there's something about her in this that I'm not quite getting on this round. And I like Renee Russo a lot. She's coming off of Get Shorty at this point. And I really loved her in Get Shorty, but she's kind of playing almost the same kind of character from Get Shorty in this. It feels samey a little bit to me. Interesting for me that Kevin Costner at this point in his career, because he's coming off the biggest disaster of his career after having this huge like 90s where he is the top star, and then Waterworld comes along and suddenly he's all right, well, maybe I should go back to doing sports movies with Ron Shelton then, and trying to get
like
back
when
to world.
Jim Carrey made Bruce Almighty and got back with the Liar Liar crew.
yeah, exactly. So, anyway, I love this movie. I think Don Johnson makes a pretty good villain. It's really interesting. I know this happens all the time. We see tournaments that happen like this all the time. After the first day, Sims has got, I think he's got a 7-under on the first day. And then he's supposedly this conservative, player who does all the smart things all the time and whatever. And he's still at 7-under on the last day. So he must've just shot par the entire time until he got to the final. I don't get it. And like McElroy, he goes 10 under on the second day. He must go like 9-under on the next day to get down, to come from 11 over to down to 7-under. I mean, that's just ridiculous, you know? Yeah. And then like the same thing happens in Happy Gilmore, where, like, you know, Happy Gilmore learns how to putt, and it's like, if you can drive 400 yards and you've learned how to putt, how is this even a close match at the end? And the same thing happens with this movie for me, is that, you know, here's a guy who's quite excellent at taking chances. Of course, like you said, they keep climbing him up a tree in these things. That final round, he can't hit anything correctly on those first two holes, and he takes a double bogey, I think, right off, or he takes two straight bogeys, and to right off the bat and everything. It is interesting that you mentioned that pro golfers don't get the yips, because this is a well-known thing for pro baseball players to go through, mm-hmm. is the yips. Steve Sachs famously couldn't throw the ball to first base. Rick Ankiel, as a pitcher, famously lost all of his control and was throwing a bunch of wild pitches and hits batsmen and everything in a playoff game against the Braves. And, like, they had to convert him to an outfielder later because he couldn't pitch anymore. I think John Lester was another one who couldn't throw the ball to first base whenever the ball got to him. So the yips are a very real thing in baseball that happened to be. I mean, it doesn't happen often. It's like,
I mean, pro golfers lose their swing for sure, mm-hmm. but they don't shank it straight to the right every single time they hit it.
He's hitting it like a negative X graph on that, on those balls. He's hitting it right at the other players. I very much enjoyed this movie, and we see why Kevin Costner is a star during this. I think he's probably super relaxed after doing Waterworld.
Yeah, so, he also, funny you mentioned Happy Gilmore, he apparently, according to IMDb, turned down the Shooter McGavin role in Happy Gilmore
really?
To make this instead.
So. Also interesting, too, that they came up with a character name of Roy McAvoy, and we now have a guy named Rory McIlroy, who's almost the exact name. So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's what I thought about Tin Cup.
Aaron? The year was 1987. My dad had a connection to someone who caddied for Paul Azinger. Paul Azinger was a professional golfer of some acclaim during that time, but he was also friends with another unacclaimed golfer named Dewey Arnett. I don't know if that name rings a bell with anyone, but he was invited to go to the 1987 Buick Open and go with the foursome that Dewey Arnett was in and go hole to hole with them and hang out with them. So he went to the 1987 Buick Open, and Dewey Arnett managed to rattle off 8 birdies in a row, tying the PGA record for number of birdies in a row at the time. Since then, somebody's got 9, but at the time, it was tying a record. And this, to me, is the absolute beauty of golf, is that you get hot, you get streaky, and all of a sudden, as an individual sport, you just do something that nobody expected, nobody thought you can do, and it's so, it's just such an underdog feeling when that kind of stuff happens. That is the beauty of this movie. That is the thing that they're going for in this movie. I had mixed feelings on this movie back when I originally saw it. I saw it a couple times back in the day. I still have mixed feelings. In fact, I'm probably right about where I was, but I think what makes this movie work is that combined with Kevin Costner. And this movie is kind of a test in some ways of Kevin Costner's charisma and likability, because the character he's playing, not actually a good guy. He's interesting, but he makes bad choices. And the movie rewards him for his bad choices in some way and makes that part of his character at the end. It's an interesting movie where the protagonist, if they have an arc, it's not that they change that core part of themselves, it's that they accept that core part of themselves, which is an interesting thing to elevate, to accept pride. That's an interesting thing to go, yeah, that's a good part of you. That's a fun part of you. That won't damage people in your life or make you selfish in ways. So that's probably where the mixed feelings come from, is kind of the overall, like, where this movie goes, kind of what it seems to elevate is the antithesis of what I would think I would want to be as a human being in this world. You know, because those decisions don't always just affect yourself. Even in that situation, I don't know if there are other people on his team who get paid based on where he places, or, you know, oftentimes their incentives, those kind of things. Like, you know, sometimes it's not just yourself that you're thinking of. But he is so charming in this movie, even as he is doing inappropriate things in how he's dealing with Rene Russo, even as he is making dumb decision after dumb decision. He's just so charming doing it that I think you're along for the ride and have a good time. I think there's this idea that's the other part of why I come away with mixed feelings. And by the way, I think I would say, if somebody said, like, you know, do you like this movie? I think I would say, yes, I like this movie. It's fun to watch. It's an enjoyable watch for sure. It's written very well and it progresses very well. But the final reason I have mixed feelings on it is it kind of inches into this thing of infamy chasing, the idea that, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you're remembered. Mm. And the idea that you're better off hitting, you know, six balls into the lake because that'll be a legend and be remembered than you are to actually pursue excellence or pursue success or make the right decision or whatever the case may be. And I just see it so much in our culture sometimes, this idea of doing anything you can to be remembered, no matter what the moral choices or the consequences are. And so there's just that little bit of infamy chasing that just doesn't sit right with me at the end too, which is another reason.
I get that. I don't read it the same way. I think the movie is certainly saying he fucked up. I just think that's Rene Russo's way of comforting him.
Yeah. I actually didn't get that either. The idea that he's doing it for the infamy. He's doing it because, damn it, I know I can hit that shot. I won't ever get a chance to do it again. And here's my chance to do it. And it has nothing to do with the score or infamy or anything at that point.
But, yeah, anyway, I think I
cut you off, Jeremy.
No. I think that's valid. And I don't think, so maybe infamy chasing is wrong, because you're right. I don't know that he's necessarily chasing infamy. He is giving into what I would say are his worst instincts. But the movie makes it a celebration. Like, when he finally holes out, it is just as big as, you know, Hoosiers when they hit the free throw. You know what I mean? Like, it is meant to be a huge celebration, you know, when he does that. And so there's an honoring to it.
Three or four people dive in the water for the,
like, yeah, the ball that will be remembered. Yeah, yeah. As if they could possibly know that the ball that they get from down there is his.
I mean, there's not only his that he knocked in, but there's probably 500 others that have been knocked in.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, overall, I do enjoy watching this movie, but I'm nothing if not me, and I get distracted by sometimes messages or themes that I go, I'm not sure I see the world exactly like that, and that's and that's okay. That's all right.
All right, well, that's fair enough.
Going to the broadcast team, like, again, I could make the whole movie could be these guys.
They're so good.
I would just watch that. What's that?
Little Town in West Texas.
Yes. There's a line in here that I've used before where somebody just keeps doing something and the director's like, somebody tackle him.
That's perfect.
And the director of this is just amazing the entire time. He's like, oh, what is this? This nobody from West Texas. I need heroes is what I need. I don't need this, you know, this nonsense or whatever. But yeah, again, like, if they made a whole 10 cup TV show about just these guys, I would watch.
I love it because he says Little Town in West Texas like two or three times, and then the guy, I think it's the director or producer, is like, yes, thank you for West Texas. Thank you.
It
feels like very authentic to what that environment would be like.
The other thing the movie deserves props for is the cameos in this movie are numerous. From the broadcast team to the actual golfers. And they're integrated for the most part in a non-invasive way. I think there's one conversation between a couple of pros that I could have done without that felt a little forced, and you could tell they weren't actors, and that's okay.
Oh, God. That was so stupid. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. But other than that, it's really integrated well. And I think everybody performs pretty well at what they're doing in their cameos. So, yeah, I think the movie deserves props for that.
You get baby Phil Mickelson in the background on that.
Yeah.
first pro-am where he's caddying for David Sims. Mickelson looks like he's 22 in this movie. But yeah, I also, I looked up, I one time went down a rabbit hole about this golf hole. That is the 18th hole of this tournament. And it's not even on the 18th hole in real life. It's like the 13th hole on the real course. And it's not, I don't think it's even a par five. It's just a, so they were just like dropping a ball out there and making like he had hit a 300-yard drive and now is going for the green in two, but it's actually like a par four. Anyway, I think that's fun.
That does it. This movie's terrible then. I mean, you can't do something like that and expect me to like your movie. I mean, come on.
It is kind of interesting that we had two really big golf movies in 1996, and they're both kind of like the same type of deal. I mean, obviously, Happy Gilmore is a zanier movie, but it's an outsider essentially coming in to the an actual pro tour and with his own brand of, you know, his attitude and everything like that. He, you know, he in Happy Gilmore, it becomes a thing where he's super popular and whatever. And then, you know, who knows what happens with Roy McAvoy after this? I mean, the chances are he just doesn't become a pro after this. He just retires after that U.S. Open and doesn't do anything.
She suggests he get his tour card, but like we already heard the story from Romeo when he was like, all he had to do was make the safe choice to get his tour card when he was a young guy, and he couldn't do it then. He's not going to be able to do it now,
right? But we get those two movies in 1996, and then I think we get Tiger Woods in 1997. Like, it's almost like the embodiment, and like not that Tiger Woods is Roy McAvoy and Happy Gilmore, but somebody who infused interest in the sport comes in like right after that. Like that, I think golf was kind of like, you know, people kind of watched it. Tiger Woods sort of made everybody watch it there for a while.
Yeah.
You know, just the sheer dominance crazy. And the attitude and everything. So.
Well, that's the thing. When Aaron was talking about 1980, it was 1987, and some random no-name golfer gets eight straight birdies and goes on a hot streak. That's what I like about golf, generally speaking, is that no matter which stars are in the field, it could still be won by a guy you've never heard of just because he was playing great golf. The exception to that is, currently, if Scottie Scheffler's in the field, and then back in Tiger Woods' day, if Tiger was in the field, I mean, there was just so much greater chance he was going to win. He really upset that any man can win balance by being so great.
And he did it. He did it through. I mean, it wasn't that he played a boring game either. He like there are things that Tiger Woods has done. I'm not that big into golf. Like, I'm not nearly as into it as you guys are. But like, Tiger Woods has done things on that I've seen him do on a Masters or something that are imprinted in my brain. That's how ridiculous they were. Like, it didn't, like, he would hit a shot that would go in the woods and you're like, oh man, he doesn't have much of a chance out of that. And he would find a way to do it. You're like, you'd wonder if it was he was cheating, if he was putting in the Konami code or something, and he's getting the, you know, how is in the world was he getting these balls back to where, you know, it was he could get a par or even a birdie sometimes. It was silly. It was just silly.
That 97 Masters performance is etched in my brain. Like, it was insane to watch him shoot like four sub 70 rounds. Like, he was 18 under by the end of the tournament, and the closest to him was like five under or something. It was ridiculous. Like, the tournament was over by the middle of the third round. Yeah. You'd never seen anything like it. And it's hard to explain.
He was a shot shaper unlike anyone else. My favorite shot of his, I'll find it and send it to you guys on Slack later, but I think it was a PGA tournament, and he's in the rough and the woods on the left, and he's still 230, 240 from the green. And he shaped a shot that went right to left. I bet that thing broke a football field length. And I've never seen anyone intentionally hook a shot that far, and it goes out of the woods, out of the rough, and eventually curved and lands on the green, rolls up to the cup. It was one of the best shots I've ever seen in my entire life. And he's got flashier shots, but that one to me stands out.
It feels like any time, and Tiger Woods got to be great for a really long time before all the personal troubles and his own physical troubles started seeping in and everything. But it seems like every time we have a chance at like a decade of sustained greatness from someone, something happens to that person. I don't know what's going on. Like even Michael Jordan had that period of time where it was like, if he just stayed in the league and there wasn't any labor troubles or anything like that, he's rattling off 8 or 9 championships in a row probably, but because all that happened. Of course, he was always rumored because of his gambling or whatever. He wasn't allowed back in the NBA for 2 years or something. I don't know about that, but Bo Jackson was another guy. Like, we could have seen greatness in 2 sports and just like, he gets hurt on a real fluke play and he can't play either sport after that. And just like, it's just sad to think that type of thing. It hasn't had anything to do with Tin Cup really, but
no, we kind of played the end of that discussion. Like we do our outtake discussion in the early show prep where we just kind of veer, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I liked it.
But did Tiger Woods ever hit a ball off of a porta potty? That's what I need to know.
I'm sure he has.
If he didn't do that, then
he probably saw this movie and then did that while he was 17.
Yeah. All right. Let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what do you got for us?
I won't say my also-rans, although I was really tempted to, with the plethora of Kevin Costner in sports movies, there are a lot of good options, but I think I found a movie that's pretty much identical to this movie. It features a down on their luck owner of a sports establishment who is trying to find a way to win the girl that he's in a little bit of a love triangle with by pursuing sports, goes through some very, let's just say, unconventional training to do so, ends up winning the big game, but not exactly in the way you think he's going to be celebrated. That's right. This is exactly the same movie as Dodgeball.
Yes, correct.
So there's a lot of similarity between Vince Vaughn's character here and the Tin Cup character in Tin Cup. Mm-hmm. The only difference being the tone of the movie and also Kevin Costner's incredible charisma. So, but yeah, it struck me as really funny how similar the plots to these movies are, and I thought that would be a fun double feature.
So every time Lance Armstrong cameo shows up in that movie, it takes me out completely.
Yeah. Yep.
I also went with a sports movie, one where the player has a break from, he could have been a huge star, and then much later in life, that's when he finally gets his chance. And also the love of a good woman ends up being what gets him back on track once he starts failing, and that's The Natural. I saw a lot of similarities to this. There's even a shot of psychology in The Natural, but that guy's a quack. I don't think they're really saying that psychology in general is bad, but I almost because that's the only representation of any kind of psychology in that movie, it makes it sound like all psychologists are this way. But it has that, and just the fact that he's great, and then because he falls for the wrong woman, and he starts sort of like losing sight of baseball and everything. That's why he starts, going downhill. And then finally he meets his old childhood sweetheart, and that's when he starts hitting well again and all that. So it's just it's a lot of similarities. You talk about differences in tone. The Natural is completely different from Tin Cup, but there are a lot of similarities in how sports are seen and what makes you a great sports guy. Makes you a great sports guy. Good at the ball, you know? So
we like sports, and we don't care who knows.
Yes. All right. Next week's homework, I believe it is Aaron Stern. So what do we be watching next week, Aaron?
Oh, my. We're going to 1998. Listen, I am who I am. I love this movie. I haven't seen it in a little bit, and I think I'm a little bit out of my island already loving this movie, but I really want to talk about it. It is a movie by the same director of Galaxy Quest, so you know there's talent there. It is a movie that was written by Vince Gilligan of Breaking Bad fame and X-Files fame. I love the movie Home Fries, and this is one that's completely under the radar. And man, I don't remember many other people liking this movie. So it's okay if I'm the only one, but I do want to watch this again and talk about it because I remember thinking it was really well done, really well written.
Well, I saw this, and that's about all I can say. I knew these two were in it. I think there's a restaurant. That's all I got.
Shelley Duvall, Catherine O'Hara, both in it as well. So yeah, it's on Plex, free to stream on Plex. If you want to check it out.
You have picked a movie that I can't remember if I've seen.
There you go.
So it'll be like watching it for the first time when I do watch it again. This came out during a period of time where, like, I would watch something like this and would just, because Drew Barrymore was in a lot of these kind of movies in the late 90s, like Boys on the Side and what was it? There was some other one like that that was just like riding in cars with boys and, you know, stuff like that. But I don't know if those movies are even in any way similar to this at all. I'm just saying it just like a title that you're like, oh, yeah, may have seen that once. Anyway, you know, that type of thing. So yeah, it'll be interesting to take a look at this one. I was shocked when I saw this on the homework list, but that makes it a good pick. So
nice. We'll see.
I can't wait to see it to see if, you know, Jeremy and I just pick you apart for even thinking about
it. It's very possible. I didn't even check like the Rotten Tomatoes. Oh yeah, it's like 31% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, so here we go.
That's got to be the record for this show. Low for this show.
It might be.
How bad is the 13th Warrior?
No, 13th Warrior might be vying for it. On that. All right.
33.
Oh, just barely below.
I win.
All right. Awesome. So the week after that, The Room, so I can win. That's all I want to do. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you for coming out and watching us today. We appreciate you very much. Thank you for that. Next week will be Home Fries, and so we will see you next time. That's going to do it. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Well, I'm almost there. I'm almost there.
Almost.
I almost have every best picture on physical medium.
Ooh, what are we missing?
And they will just need to be delivered. Those are the, I'm waiting for the remaining ones. The ones that I don't have right now are GG, The Greatest Show on Earth, which does not have a Blu-ray. Oh, it did, but isn't in print anymore, or at least that I can find. Coda, which is a, you know, it's an Apple TV thing that mm-hmm. you can only buy a foreign DVD or whatever to get that. I actually got a, I got a 4K Italian version of Coda. I think that's it. I think everything else, I just basically just anything that it was missing in that collection, I just went ahead and snapped up, a week or so ago, and I got this huge delivery the other day of all these movies. And I know some of these are hot garbage these days. Some of these best pictures are probably not very good, anymore, but yeah, I think it's three more and I've got them all.
Nice. I was just looking because sometimes those streamers, Criterion will snag them up and do a release. Mm-hmm. Looks like maybe Criterion did a Coda release.
Oh, did they?
Or maybe it's coming out. Maybe it's not out yet. Ah, yeah, set to release on July 1st.
Of course.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, it's fine. It's fine.
You can watch it in Italian. That'll work.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing about those... the, you know, the foreign DVDs or whatever is like it's usually in English. It usually has English subtitles. They've just added the Italian or whatever they needed to add for whatever release it is. And so the only issue is that you put something on your shelf that's like got a completely different name sometimes. Like
right.
Glengarry Glen Ross is at the time I bought the Blu-ray, it was either out of print or I don't know what was going on with it, but they eventually came out later with like a 4K steelbook or something. I don't know. It was like a new release of it, but the version I have is it's another Italian one, and it just says Americani.
Nice.
That's the name of Glengarry Glen Ross.
Americani.
So is the crown jewel of this collection Crash or Shakespeare in Love?
Well, when you have that kind of decision, oh, it's really just like looking at your children, right? the other thing that sucks about this kind of thing, I only made one mistake with this buying spree, is you put in a title for something, and that movie has like 400 remakes, and you look at something that's old, and so you think, well, that's the one that came out that was Best Picture or whatever. And so I bought one of them, and it was Cimarron. Cimarron won Best Picture in like 1931 or something like that. And there's another one that came out in 1960. And I bought the 1960 one first. And so I bought all these things. And then after it said your order is ready or are going to be shipped soon or whatever, it said other people bought. And it was like this other Cimarron down there that was from 1930. And I was like, is that different from the one that I just bought? Yes, it is. So I have two different versions of a movie that I've never seen. But yeah, they have a bunch like great Around the World in 80 Days obviously has several. There was a Jackie Chan version of that. I don't know how many years ago, Around the World in 80 Days. And there's like a couple others, I think, but, the one that won Best Picture was from the '60s. So
yeah, I think there's a TV show too. It's out on Blu-ray.
Yeah. So there were quite a few of those, and there's a lot of those with like Coda was another one that I could have possibly messed up, because you put in Coda into a search engine and it comes up with some Patrick Stewart, Katie Holmes movie called Coda. And there's a two actors I've never thought worked together before.
Patrick Stewart and Katie Holmes?
They're in a movie called Coda. And I don't know what it's about. I think it's AI. Like a piano playing movie or something. I don't know.
What?
But yeah, a lot of these have such generic titles that it's hard to like discern which one am I supposed to get here.
Yeah, it's 2019.
Angie and Carlo Esposito. Mm-hmm. Holy shit.
Oh man, that was wild. I watched Taps. A couple of days ago. I've never seen Taps before. I had always heard of it because Tom Cruise, Sean Penn, all these guys got their start in the movie Taps. And I always had in my head what that movie was about, and I had no idea. I watched it. I didn't like it very much. But there was a character in there, and I was like, is that Giancarlo Esposito as like an 18-year-old? And it sure was.
That's amazing.
Oh my God, sure
was.
That's
he awesome. Looks completely different, by the way. I just kind of guessed, and I was right.
That's awesome.
My favorite my favorite recent example of that is when we were sending Karate Kid Part 2 and B.D. Wong shows up for one line in the crowd. Like a completely unknown B.D. Wong just popping in.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
I love when that happens. I was watching... HBO was running a marathon of The Sopranos a month or two ago. I don't know, I was watching most of it or had it on. And Tony Hale from, what's the name of that fucking show?
Arrested Development?
Arrested Development. It's just there as a nurse. He's just in a scene as a nurse at the hospital.
That's really the entirety of Law and Order, right? Like, if you go... and watch, yeah, our buddy Patrick watches Law and Order a bunch. Just like will give me texts every once in a while and like show picture of somebody, and I'm like, oh wow, is that like their first thing they've ever done? And usually kind of is, or it was like in the middle of their early part of their career or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is that show had a really great casting department, and part of it is that show ran for 75 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's one of the best places to go to catch actors before they were famous.
If you look at almost any actor's IMDb resume, if they're not on a Law and Order, they're on one of the different other Law and Orders in their career. Nearly every actor that you can pick is on a Law and Order at some point.
The thing I was thinking of was the Bader Meinhof phenomenon, which actually specifically is more about the first time you see something and then it pops up everywhere. But it's all in the area of selective attention. Like if something, you know, matches, you have the selective attention to see both things.
That's like when Jeremy wrote a thing in a Star Trek video a long time ago where it was something about... happy wife, happy life or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't think I've ever seen that phrase ever. And then everybody was saying it around me right afterwards.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, I guess that is a thing. I mean, and obviously it's a thing. You guys have heard it a million times, but I either let it just go one ear out the other every time I heard it. And then when I finally got to that point, I was like, I've never heard that before in my life.
Yep, Bader Meinhof.
Yep.
There you go.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.